the Society for American Baseball Research. This tape will be sent to Cooperstown Hall of Fame for the Oral History Committee, and then any information here might be used by other Sabre members for research projects. And I just want to say hello, good morning, good afternoon.
Hey.
And I guess the first question I ask these ballplayers that I interview is, when did you, was there a moment that you realized that you might have a future playing professional baseball?
Oh, I guess it was in high school in 1948 or 49. And, I was at least I was hoping I had a future.
And where did you go to high school?
Balboa High School, San Francisco.
And you were a catcher from the beginning?
Yes.
And tell us about it, about Balboa.
Grew up in the city where there was a lot of ball players. And every weekend there was games to be played either at Big Rec or Funston or whatever playground. And played with all the kids we grew up with, and a lot of them went on to play pro ball, and we both became friends and got to see one another during the winter months and even played during the off seasons. Those were the good days when people came back and played ball.
And so you got signed out of high school?
I got signed 1949 right out of high school. I graduated in those days you graduated twice a year, and I graduated January of 49, and I was right out playing baseball in March.
That's great.
Signed with the Boston Braves at that time. Bill Marshall was a scout. They sent me to Ventura in the California State League, and that started my 14-year career.
And so that was single A?
Class A, California State League. I stayed there 50-51. 52, I went into Hartford in the Eastern League. 53, I was at Modesto in the California State League, and then got drafted into the Army in 1954-55. September of that year, getting out of the Army, I joined the Milwaukee Braves, which was just moved from Boston, and stayed with them 55, all of 56, part of 57, then I got sent to Toronto, which was in the International League. Stayed there 1 year, then went to option to the Sacramento and the Pacific Coast League for 3 years, which was still part of the Braves. And that was picked up by the Chicago White Sox, 61-62. Stayed there for 2 years and got to roommate with two Hall of Famers. 1 year was Nellie Fox, and the second year was Louie Aparicio. And then I got traded from the Braves to the Los Angeles Angels organization, which sent me to Hawaii to work with a young pitching staff, and that was the end of my career. 1963, I finished, and then retired.
You played in Hawaii.
Hawaii was my last year playing ball.
And did you, all those years in the minors, did you? Who else did you get to play with, or who did, any notable managers? Or
Dixie
teammates?
Walker was with Toronto. When I was with Milwaukee, it was Charlie Grimm 1 year, Fred Haney another year. And, of course, with Chicago was Hall of Fame manager Al Lopez. Some of my minor league managers were Simi Sisti, Bob Lemon, Gene Lillard in the Coast League was my first manager, which was a great help because he was an ex-catcher, and he started my career out the right way.
That's great. So in 55 then, you must have done pretty well at spring training to get invited up to the big team.
I think it was more or less from the previous year before I went in the Army, being a prospect, and then spending 2 years in the Army playing. At that time, the service ball was playing against a bunch of major leaguers that were drafted. And I guess being seen there, just went straight to the Milwaukee Braves.
And do you remember the first game you played in for the Braves?
Oh, wow.
August 16th, 1955.
Oh, really? I can't think even who the pitcher was. If I'm guessing, I think it was, and I could be wrong, I think it was Stu Miller.
You're playing against the Giants?
It could have been. No, I think he was with St. Louis in those days.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was with St. Louis. And if I remember right, it was about a 5 or 10 hopper back to the pitcher, right back to him, my first at-bat.
You played in 6 games, 9 at-bats, 2 hits, hit a double. one walk and four strikeouts. What was it like playing in Milwaukee? I heard that the fans were great.
Well, that day it was, because they just came in from Boston, so they were treating the players unbelievable. They gave each of the players, the 24 players on the roster, a new car, and that those years, the DeSoto to drive, all the gas you needed. Of course, being from Milwaukee, a great beer town, all the beer that you really needed to stock your refrigerator, and all the free cleaning, and it was a great time. It really was, and besides that, we had a great ball club.
And I heard they would barbecue during the games and have barbecues set up all over the place.
Unbelievable. And like I said, we had a great team. We had a young second baseman that just came up the previous year, Henry Aaron.
Right.
People probably don't know he started out as a second baseman.
Oh, wow, yeah, that's...
And they stuck him in the right field. And, of course, we had a lot of Hall of Famers, Warren Spahn, Eddie Matthews. So we're being a young kid coming out of the service. And at that time, 24, 25, it was a great experience.
So you came up the same year as Hank Aaron? Or he came up the year
before?
He came
up the year before.
Right.
He came up the year before.
And what was your...
And Del Crandall, also the catcher who I was behind, came up the year before from A-ball.
And who...
Thank you.
And what do you remember about Hank Aaron? What were your first impressions of him?
Well, you know, being from California and going back east into the southern states for spring training and also the Midwest, it was kind of unusual for me to see where, in those days, colored people were treated a lot different than we treated people out here. When we travel, we would have to drop off Henry Aaron, Billy Bruton, West Covington at the outskirts of town, where they would stay at hotels separately. They never ate with us in different hotels or restaurants. It was quite an experience for a young guy from California.
That's, you know, it's so funny because I've interviewed a couple other ball players who say the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Ernie Broglio,
right.
One. Jesse Gonder, of course, was black.
Yes, exactly.
Also.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, I remember Jesse Gonder saying he was shocked the first time he was told that he had to go around back to get food. It's because we didn't have that prejudice here.
No, not out here. Like I said, it was unusual for me to see that. Also in ballparks, you had separate entrances for blacks, separate for whites. You had drinking fountains for blacks, restroom for blacks and whites. It was quite an experience. And I feel bad for what they had to go through in those days. And
but there was not much you could do, really.
There was not much you can do, exactly. And
well, we were talking about Dixie Walker. Wasn't he one of the guys who objected to Jackie Robinson?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Did you get any
feedback? No. This was later in his career, when at 57 now, when
he
I played for
it,
him. He dealt with it, and we had some blacks in Sam Jethro in Toronto that never a problem then, but I think it was kind of all gone by then, or most likely all gone.
Now, what was it like in Milwaukee? Same thing?
No.
Or just let it was?
Well, yeah, it was to some extent. I know when we toured with Milwaukee and the Dodgers, toured leaving Vero Beach and Sarasota, Florida, or Bradenton, Florida, we'd go up north on a train. We'd play like for 2 weeks. And again, the blacks were staying away from where we stayed, and they would meet us at the ballpark, and after the ballpark, go on their own way. So it was still the same in 55, 56.
Some of the other guys on that team, Johnny Logan,
right.
Bobby Thompson.
Exactly.
That was the end.
That
the
was
end of
right
career.
After he come back from New York, having that big home run. That was a couple years later.
Now, who did you room with?
I roomed with Del Crandall for the whole time I was there.
They figured working together.
I guess, you know, with him coming up and being a catcher and myself being a young catcher, we can learn from one another. Actually, I learned from him.
And then there were a couple other guys on here. Rice.
Del Rice, right? He came from St. Louis. He was a veteran. He was finishing up his career. And at that time, we also had a first baseman.
White. Your name White?
Charlie White.
Charlie White.
Well, he was the catcher that I kind of replaced in the organization. You know, he was finishing up his career, and I came up as the young catcher myself, and another guy, Bob Uecker, which we were in spring training battle with one another for the third catcher or second catcher each year, and I was fortunate enough to stay there, and he was sent down.
What was he like?
He was a character in his days then too.
Was he really as bad as he said he was?
No. That's all a put on. I mean, he was a good minor league ball player that never really had the opportunity to catch every day. And if you caught every day, who knows, you know, what his career could have been like. But he made a pretty good career out of being a a backup catcher.
When was the last time you saw him?
Oh, it had to be in the early 60s, I guess.
He's like a TV movie star now.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he's made it big.
And then Andy Pafko.
Andy Pafko came over from Chicago Cubs. Exactly. And a little story about Andy Pafko. I got up once in 1956, which I was there the whole year. I got up twice, even though I was there for the 162-game schedule. I got called upon to pinch hit in July of that year, which was a surprise because after 2 months, 3 months not being active, for some reason when I came to pinch hit in the bat rack, I looked for my bat, I couldn't find it. Andy Pafko handed me his bat, which was the same model we both used. And I did get up, and in the first pitch I swung, and fortunate, the ball hit the bat, hit a home run. It was the last time I got up for the whole season, 1956. So I was 1-for-2 using Andy Pafko's bat.
How would you, what do you think your strengths were as a catcher? Let's start defensively.
Defensively, that's where my ability got me to the big leagues. I had a better than average arm, and I was considered, you know, a good receiver, which got me to the big leagues. It wasn't over my thing.
How about handling pitchers?
I think that's what kept me playing for 13 years, and later on in my career when they sent me to different clubs to work with young pitchers, that's where I think kept me along for a long time. And I could have kept playing in 1963. I was sold to Philadelphia from the Angels, but my children were getting school age, and it was getting hard to travel, and I requested to stay in the Coast League. And then in those days, the owners controlled the players. So they told me I either had to go to Syracuse to work with Philadelphia and their pitching staff, otherwise retire, and I took the option of retiring. Nowadays, it's just the opposite. The players kind of dictate to the owners.
A lot of catchers go on to become coaches and managers. Did you ever consider
coaching? I considered it. But again, there wasn't really much money involved in those days as far as young managers in the minor leagues or catchers in the minor leagues. And I had a future look with my children, so that's when I retired.
And so that team finished second your first year.
Braves. Well, yeah, if you remember right, or if you look into it. Hello, how are you? 1956, we had a two-game lead going into the last three games of the season. We were in St. Louis. Pittsburgh was in Brooklyn. And if we could have won 2 out of 3, we would have won the pennant and gone on to the World Series, because in those days there was only American and National League pennant. And we lost the Friday night game to St. Louis 5-4 in extra innings. There was a ground ball that was in the extra inning, made an error by Eddie Matthews at third that beat us 5-4. So that tied up the title between Brooklyn and Milwaukee. And the next Saturday, we lose 2-1 with Lou Burdette pitching, and Brooklyn beat Pittsburgh for the second game to put them even with us, or one game ahead of us. And then the last game, we won on a Sunday, and Brooklyn won on a Sunday with Don Newcombe, I think, won his 27th game. So they beat us by one game to go to the World Series.
And that year, that's the year they finally beat the Yankees.
Exactly.
Charlie Grimm was a manager on that team. How was he?
Great guy to play for. He was kind of a free, loose guy that kept all the players pretty loose, kind of a comedian-type manager that was a player's manager.
Sounds like Casey Stengel.
Yes, I think so. And also on that club, if you look into the who was on it, was Frank Torres, which is a brother of Frank Torres.
Mm-hmm.
And we became pretty good friends and got to know Frank. And, of course, Joe in those days was still in school, so look at the career he's had.
Not too many Italians on that team.
No.
And then so you finished second that year, and then the next year, in 56, you finished second again.
That's the year that Burdette won it again, exactly. And then I believe when I rejoined the Braves in 58, they won the pennant that year, went on to the World Series.
Right.
Is that the year that Lou Burdette won 3 games in the World Series?
They lost to the Yankees.
Is that what it was?
Three, yeah.
Okay. And then it was 57 that they won it, or three games? Or didn't win three games one year?
Yeah, 57.
Right.
Because, and then Fred Haney was the manager.
Exactly. Fred took over for Charlie Grimm in the end of 56, I believe.
And they had Red Shandies now at second,
right.
35 years old.
Right.
And Bill Keith.
And that year, let's see. So you actually played more with the White Sox than you did with the Braves.
Yeah, two full years with the White Sox.
Now, do you remember, let's see, you hit a home run for the Braves.
That was the year I told you I got up twice in 1956, hitting the home run with Andy Pafko.
With his bat. And then you hit another home run in 62.
Right, in Detroit.
What do you remember about
that? So we got one in American National League. To be honest, I can't even remember who I hit it off of. I know it was in Detroit. I couldn't even tell you if we won or lost the ball game.
Do you, is there one game or a couple games you remember above the rest?
I remember playing against Detroit after I hit the home run. Then following day, Frank Lehrie, which was a perennial 20-game winner back then in the 60s, faced him. I remember coming up in the second inning, knocked me down. I got up, fortunately I got a base hit, came back up again in the fourth or fifth inning, knocked me down again. I don't know about idea, but I remember coming up again later on in the game, he knocked me down again. So I felt like maybe I was coming somewhere when he knocked you down, you felt like maybe you arrived. But I think we won that ball game, which, I getting to play against guys like that and Al Kaline and those kind of players, it was great.
So you had your last year with the White Sox, you had a triple.
Well, that I don't even remember.
Yeah, and a stolen base.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't remember either of them. As far as the triple, somebody must have tripped in the outfield or whatever.
and you were never caught stealing, so.
Oh, so it could have been on. It could have been on the second end of a double steal. I don't recall it.
Right. And what else was I going to ask you? I had a bunch of stuff to ask you. So, did you ever get to bat it against any Hall of Fame pitchers?
Yeah, Bob Gibson. Trying to think of some in the American League. Of course, Whitey Ford. Who else did they have there? Allie Reynolds, Vic Rashi. There was a couple. I think some of my highlights that I could tell some of the kids that I managed during my American Legion days here, I called for the few pitchers that Roger Maris broke the record in Babe Ruth in 61. I remember calling for a few pitchers, Mickey Mantle had out in those years. So I was very fortunate. I got to play against a lot of Hall of Famers, and I got to play with a lot of Hall of Famers.
What was it like going into Yankee Stadium?
Oh, it was awesome. It was awesome. Just with the White Sox, which in those years were the biggest rivalry, and they would finish second, Yankees would finish first, so it was always a minimum of 45, 50,000 people, so it was a great thrill.
What were your favorite cities to play in? What cities did you not like to play in?
Oh, actually all of them were just great. But Brooklyn was great. I mean, the fans were right on top of you. You know, it was a stadium that only really held a little more than 30,000, but they were rabid fans, new baseball, great times. Going to the Polo Grounds, of course, going to Fenway Park, Wrigley Field. These are ballparks. There are a lot of them not long there anymore.
Right. And what was the Milwaukee County Stadium?
Milwaukee County Stadium.
What was that like?
It was good. It was a ballpark that was built for the Milwaukee Brewers, thank you, who in turn switched over to the Milwaukee Braves in 1954. It was a nice county stadium. It was brand new in those days. Washington Senators was in the league at that time. That was before they moved to Minnesota. If I remember right, there's only probably less than a half a dozen teams or parks that are still around in those days. The only ones I can remember are Fenway and Wrigley Field. I think right. The rest of them were all new.
Right. You got to play in the classics.
Yeah. All the classics with all the great ball players, and they're a great era of playing ball.
Maybe the one thing about Polo Grounds that was different is you'd have to the clubhouse was out in center field.
Straight away center field. So in fact, you can watch highlights of Willie Mays making that catch over his shoulders. He was out there by the clubhouse.
Did you ever, I've heard the thing that they said about Bobby Thompson, that they stole signs and that's how he hit that home run. And then your friend who gave me your phone number, Kuno Berrigan, told me that he was involved in a little sign stealing when he was with the Cubs.
It could have been out of the scoreboard with straight center field.
Right. Did you ever know of that?
I didn't. And in fact, I've known players that if they knew they could take them, they wouldn't take the signs from fear of Nolan. And in those days, there was a lot of respect. They would knock you down or hit you or drill you. And I played with one of the most fiercest competitor as a pitcher in baseball was Early Wynn, and he was finishing up his career 61-62, and he would knock down his mother. I mean, in batting practice, if you hit a ball when he was pitching batting practice around the dirt mat part of the mound, he would either knock you down or hit you. That's his own teammates. As an opposing team, if a guy hit a hard foul ball off him, he would drill you, knock you down. If he missed you and you got on first base, he would try to hit you at first base. He was mean, but that's why he's a Hall of Famer.
He
aimed behind your shoulder blades or somewhere where you can turn and take it. And he was just a competitor. I can see why he was a 300-game winner. He was mean out there. He was probably one of the toughest pitchers as far as opposing batters wanting to dig in.
Did you, what was your relationship like with umpires?
No problem. I mean, if I thought they missed it, I would let them know. And never a problem. The short time I was in ball games in major leagues, I never got thrown out of a ball game. But if you thought you had a beef coming, they would listen to you to a certain extent. And that was it.
Did you ever get in a fight?
In the major leagues, no. In the minor leagues, a couple times, most likely from getting knocked down and challenging a pitcher or whatever. One time there was a play at the plate. I thought a guy came in excessively hard, and when he hit me, I kind of put the ball into his face, and then that started a little rhubarb. But there was no punches thrown because most fights, too many ball players are on top of you to throw any punches.
Did you ever get any good collisions at the plate?
Oh yeah, there was a few that you took the worst of, especially on a close play where you see the runner coming and you look for the ball, and that's when he usually hits you. But fortunate, no major injuries.
Now, you talk a lot about the catching strategy, about how important it is to frame the ball. And even if the pitch doesn't go over the plate, if you don't have to move your mitt, a lot of times that'll, the umpire will call it a strike.
Yeah.
Because that's where you told the pitcher to throw it.
You go back now, in my era, which is 20 years ago or even more, catchers would catch two-handed to frame a ball. Nowadays, because of people and the value of a catcher, they all catch one-handed to keep the meat hand out of the way. So it's not as much framing the ball today as it was in those days.
Did you ever get injured?
Only in minor league ball at Sacramento in 1959, I believe. I caught a foul ball off my hand and broke my hand early in the season and sat out for 6 weeks. Came back a little too early and got hit again and rebroke it, and that was about the only time I really had any major injury.
Were there any other milestones or historical moments in baseball that you got to see from the dugout being a player? No hitters?
Well, I seen Joe Adcock hit four home runs.
Number 89.
The other milestone, I seen Willie Mays hit four against us one season when he was with the Giants and we were in Milwaukee. I seen a no-hitter pitched against us in Chicago by Billy Mambo Kett, who was with Boston. I just was fortunate to see Hank Aaron, his 2 years that I was there, just have tremendous seasons, starting out as a young guy hitting his first 20 or 30 home runs on his way to his career 700 and whatever. And then I was fortunate to catch Early Wynn in his 296, 97, 98, 99th game. He missed his 300th game because the season ended, and he picked it up the following year. But,
He toward the end there?
I mean, he was definitely towards the end.
I wonder how many wins he got total.
Well, I could be wrong, but I think it's 300, 301. It's not much more.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, he struggled the last five or six starts in Chicago trying to get it, and he tried, but it just came up short.
What was he like socially?
Greatest guy in the world. I mean, if you went out with him, the group of guys, you went to dinner, and then you went to have a cocktail or beer afterwards, he would not let you pick up a check. In fact, he demanded you didn't pick up a check, so yeah. You just let him buy. Yeah. But no, he was a good guy. And at that time, he was making, you know, big dollars considered from what some of the other players were making.
Did any of these teams, were they known for carousing?
Not that I know of. I guess in every ball club there's one or two, but no. It's more publicized now because reporters look for things to say. In our days, whatever happened was kind of covered up.
Right. Did you guys, when you went out, did you go out in groups usually?
There was usually three or four that hung around together. The White Sox, I hung around with Jim Landis and Nellie Fox, who was my roommate, and Sam Esposito. And Chicago, I hung around with Chuck Tanner and Del Crandall. And you usually go around with two or three people.
What was Spahn like?
He was kind of a comedian type of guy, on and off the field, always loose, kept the players loose.
Thank you.
You better show it. he was, as a young rookie, he would get a cigarette and put it in your belt lapel and burn it, or if you weren't paying attention, he would light your shoestrings on fire. And he was a good all-around guy. Plus, he probably the greatest left-hand pitcher in baseball.
Talk about longevity. The guy was pitched forever.
Well, 1956, and of course, 57, 58, when I was on there off and on, he was, 340-something wins in those days, and how old was he then? Close to 40?
34.
Yeah, 34?
34.
He pitched till he was, what, 40?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was 17 and 14 that year.
Yeah.
You guys had some good pitchers with Lou Burdett, Warren Spahn, Bob Uhl, Gene Conley, and Chet Nichols.
Right. And then Ernie Johnson was one of the relief pitchers, and his son's now the big announcer in sports.
So he was the closer, or he didn't really have a closer?
We didn't really have a closer in those days. In fact, and go back in those days, most pitchers seemed to go nine innings. You know, pitch 300 innings each, or you'd have one guy that was... Ernie Johnson might come in, or Dave Jolly, or I can't think who else we had as pitchers in those days. But most pitchers those days pitched eight or nine innings.
Johnson, Jolly, Vargas, Krohn, Robinson, Payne, Jay, Edelman, Gorin, Kozlov.
Yeah, there was really no set closer in those days.
Not like today where they bring somebody in for a while.
Yeah, today you got specialists. You got middle men, you got short men. You got left-handed setup people, and you got a little bit of everything.
So who was the best pitcher that you ever faced?
Faced? Oh, boy.
Left-handed, did you ever face Koufax?
I was just going to say, left-handed pitcher would be Sandy Koufax. Right-hand pitcher, it'd have to be Bob Gibson with a close to Drysdale being second. And you talk about two tough pitchers that commanded that they wanted their share of the plate was both Gibson and Drysdale. I guess those were the two toughest pitchers.
So then in 61, you went to the White Sox.
Right.
And you said you got to play with Aparicio.
Aparicio was my roommate for the first 6 months. I roomed with him. Nellie Fox and Billy Pierce were roommates. And in the middle of 61, Billy Pierce got traded to the San Francisco Giants. Then I switched over and became Nellie Fox's roommate. And Nellie Fox, a Hall of Famer, on and off the field. He was probably the best gentleman you could meet on and off the field as far as rooming with a young person, how he treated you, and just a down-to-earth person.
And why do you think it took so long for him to get into the Hall of Fame?
Well, probably because he was more or less considered a modern-day slap hitter. He would get over 200 hits a year. Probably 175 of them were base hits to the opposite field or a few bunts thrown in. That's the only reason I can think of. He didn't hit for power, didn't drive in a lot of runs, but he would hit second behind Aparicio, let Aparicio steal. He'd take a pitch, take two pitches. He should have gone in sooner, but he was definitely a Hall of Famer on and off the field.
How was he defensively?
More than adequate. in those days, I guess that was the top shortstop, Dual Aparicio and Fox. I can't remember who else could have been any better.
He said that Aparicio just made some amazing plays.
Unbelievable. I guess one of any ball player could have been better with the Yazzie Smith, but Aparicio was just had the greatest pair of hands you ever want to see.
And then what was the pitching like on that team?
I can't really recall who our top starters were.
I don't have that. I just typed out your
We had Bob Shaw, I remember. We had Juan Pizarro. I can't really remember who our really top ace of the staff was. Early Wynn, which was finishing up his career, he would probably pitch every fifth, 6 days. We had in the bullpen, I remember Turk Lound, Jerry Staley. I really can't. Gene Conley. I can't really remember who we had in those days.
What do you think about the fact that people say that you steal on the pitcher more than
I think it's more than without a doubt. I mean, any catcher in the major leagues with a halfway decent arm, if a player's held on first, should be thrown out. So, yeah, you do steal off the pitcher without a doubt.
And then what about they say that back then the pitchers would mess with the ball more, and they were spitter, and guys would put a groove in it?
Well, I played with probably the guy that was considered the best cheater of all times, Lou Burdett. Yes, without a doubt he did. He would, in certain situations, he would let you know the ball was loaded up and don't give a sign, hurry up, and so he can throw it.
I see. Because if there's hesitation, then it might be
then
it
could dry, exactly.
Did the umps ever say anything to you?
No. They didn't really question it too much in those days, but he would only throw it in a critical situation. But, yeah, there were other pitchers that scuffed up the ball or threw it, but... that was part of baseball in those days, like getting knocked down in those days. Nowadays, you see guys hit home runs and they trot around the bases, they point to the sky. In those days, believe me, if you did it, you were either going to get drilled or you were going to get knocked down. But today, you just don't seem to have those type of pitches anymore. There's a few out there that would do it, but in those days, everybody did it.
If a pitcher wanted to, did a pitcher ever would he signal to you if he wanted to hit
yes.
a guy?
No. Well, you just ask for a fastball, of course. You know, if you put down a curvy shake, you also hit you with a fastball. But and a lot of times, before you can even give a sign, you'd be in a windup, so you kind of expect what was going to happen.
Did you ever have any pitchers that would shake you off a lot?
No, not really. Not really. And going again back into our days, I think the catcher called all the pitches. I don't remember at all in my career a manager calling signals for myself, and they never called them for Del Crandall with the Braves. They never called it with Sherm Lawler with the White Sox. We all called our own pitches. Of course, we would go over the hitters before the game and what to throw and when to throw them, so it was a little different then.
And based on with the pitcher.
Hang on 1 second. Can I help you?
So... how did that White Sox team do?
We finished second both years to the New York Yankees, which in those years they've won 4, 5, 6, 7 in a row, and I'm talking with Merrill, Maris, Mantle, Vera, Whitey Ford, Tony Kubek, Kenny Boyer, Pepitone at first, Elston Howard. They were just a super ball club and probably one of the top all-time ball clubs in modern baseball.
So that means that for the 5 years you played, the teams you're on never finished lower than second.
Right. Yeah, well, it would just be with the right ball club at the right time. Well, yeah, I was on good teams. Unfortunate for myself as an individual, I was with all-star catchers. The years I was with Milwaukee, Dale Crandall was the all-star catcher. The years I was with Chicago, Sherm Lawler was the MVP plus the all-star catcher. So it put me into a backup, but great experience. I've got no complaints.
Yeah. Who do you still see? What relationships have lasted?
The only ones really, Jim Landis.
He lives in Napa.
He lives in Napa. We played golf a couple of times a year together. That's really about the only ones in the big leagues. But I do see some at some of the functions, like the Sabre meeting. I see Charlie Severa and other minor leaguers, and Bud Watkins, Kuno, different people that I play ball in the minor leagues with. But as far as major league players, Ernie Broglio I see all the time. We had an organization out here with the major league alumni, which
right.
was Frank Zuppo, myself. Who else was on it? Charlie Severa. Can't think of who else was on it.
Somebody.
The manager used to for the Giants at one time. Now he's very, very sick with Alzheimer's.
Not Roger Craig.
No. Before him.
Charlie Fox?
Charlie Fox. In fact, I just talked to his wife not too long ago. He's in Palm Springs, very, very bad shape.
But you played in the Pacific Coast League, right?
Three years. Actually,
Sacramento.
4 or 5 years. Sacramento, 3 years, and then with my career ended with Hawaii.
So did you ever go to the one that they have at Golden Gate Park? Every year, I think they have a reunion.
Well, they have one over in Oakland Civic Auditorium.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, in fact, I just went to the one last year. And that's a lot of old-time ball players were there. Billy Romani was there. Charlie Severa, which played for Salt Lake the year I was there in 58 or 59. Bud Watkins, Conan Berrigan. A lot of old-time ball players.
Who do you think was the best catcher you ever saw? Yogi, or you saw Campanella play?
Yeah, but yeah, of course he was catching for overall, defensively and offensively. Yeah, I'd have to say it would be between Yogi Berra, Roy Campanella. Defensively, without a doubt, I think Del Crandall was the best handler of the pitchers. But when you combine offense and defense, then I'd have to say it would be Yogi Berra or Roy Campanella. And I didn't get to see Johnny Bench, so I can't come on, you know. And then Yvonne Rodriguez looks like the modern-day catcher.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Offensively and defensively.
Do you remember throwing out any famous base stealers?
No, I don't. But if I remember right, what little I did catch, there wasn't too many stolen bases against me. But no, I don't remember who it could have been.
Do you recall anybody ever trying to steal home on you?
No. No, not at all. No, I can't remember that at all.
We were watching the History of the World Series. I got this new DVD. They showed that when Jackie Robinson stole
home.
He was out.
Yeah.
I mean, he was out. Yogi did a perfect job.
That's when Yogi jumped up.
Yeah.
And that was another one of my great thrills, getting to my first year. I broke in 1955 with Milwaukee. We played in Brooklyn. Jackie Robinson was finishing his career there, so I got to see that ball club with Gil Hodges and Jackie Robinson and Carl Furillo, and that stadium alone was just, you know, history. You know, being from the West Coast, getting to, you know, in those days we never got TV, so we never got to even see the stadiums, but getting to join it and see them, it was amazing. Yeah, some good memories.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's just must have been such a thrill.
Have you been back there to see some of these stadiums?
No, I mean, I saw, you know, Percy Wrigley, and I went to Fenway.
Yeah.
I did go to Fenway.
Yeah.
But, I would have loved to have seen the Ebbets before I was too young.
Yeah, so that was something with the short right field with all the signs on there. And, of course, Andy Papko was playing left that year, and Duke Snyder was in center, and Carl Floro in right, and Newcomb pitching, and thank you. Who else they have? Johnny Padres. It was quite a ball club.
Could you start to see the wear and tear on these stadiums because they were getting old? The Polo Grounds wasn't that well kept.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. But that was, it was just great getting to those stadiums there. At, left field foul line, right field foul line was like 257. If you pulled it, Bobby Thompson's historic right. home run was right down the line, which might not even been 300 feet, but it's not how you hit him, it's where you hit him. And then 2 years later, there he was with us in Milwaukee.
I can't really think of anything else. You've been great. I appreciate it.
All right. I'll tell you a little story, though. A couple of the funniest things I got involved in baseball with. We were in Milwaukee County Stadium playing the New York Giants. hitting third was Henry Aaron. Hitting fourth was Eddie Matthews. Hitting fifth was Joe Adcock. And the pitcher was Ruben Gomez, right-handed Latin pitcher, which had a history of knocking down hitters. And Aaron hit a home run. Eddie Matthews come up, he hit a home run. Up comes Joe Adcock, and first pitch, he drills Joe right in the ribs. Joe took it, started to walk towards first base, and Ruben Gomez shouted something, and whatever he shouted, it was the wrong thing, and before you knew it, Adcock ran after him. Well, he chased him toward shortstop, he chased him around second, he crossed over the mound, and Ruben Gomez crossed the mound, crossed the third baseline, into the dugout, up into the clubhouse, never came out.
He was scared.
Well, in those days, yeah, Adcock was, what, 6 foot four, and Ruben was probably 4'10", 160 pounds soaking wet, but it was kind of comical when you watched it because it was never going to catch him. But for him just to cross the line, down the dugout, into the clubhouse, and never came back out, and that was one of the funniest things that in baseball. And another one, 1963 in Hawaii. We were home in Hawaii. Bo Belinsky, I guess you heard about Bo Belinsky. He got sent down from the California Angels down to Hawaii. It wasn't so much of his pitching ability, it was more of his off-field abilities. Well, the first game in Hawaii that he pitched, he come from the bullpen, start the game. I'm behind the plate. First pitch, winds up, kicks his right leg high because he was a left-hand pitcher. Throws a fastball. I forget if it was a ball or strike. And as he throws the ball, we hear a little bell, tinkle, tinkle, tinkle. The umpire taps on my shoulder. He said, "Did you hear something?" I said, "Well, I thought I heard a sign of a kind of a bell." He asked me if it was me. I said, "No, it wasn't me." Throw the ball back to the pitcher, Bo, and give another sign, throws another pitch. Tinkle, tinkle, tinkle again. The umpire calls time and he says, "What the hell is that?" I said, "Be damned if I know." We, the umpire and myself, we walk out to the mound. There's Bo Belinsky on his right foot tied in his shoelace. He has little bells like kids wear when you grow up.
Right.
So every time he lifted up his foot, it would tinkle while the umpire made him take it off. But that was Bo. He was one of a kind.
Didn't he date like some starlets?
In fact, we made some road trips. Go ahead. We made road trips from Hawaii. We were 2 weeks in Hawaii, 2 weeks on the road. Well, when Bo joined us half into the season, on our road trips in the States, Mamie Van Doren, the Hollywood starlet in those days, would join him on the road trip. I was his roommate, where I roommate with another ball player.
They let him room. Oh, the team didn't know, or they didn't care.
Well, I don't think they really cared. I think he was kind of a celebrity with us. And if she probably had her own room, but he would spend it with her. But that was Bo.
He had a good time, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He enjoyed life. In fact, I just seen Bo probably a year ago before he passed away, and it caught up to him, his nightlife.
Really, the drinking?
Yeah. Well, combination, a little bit of everything, but he probably died. He was probably, I'm guessing, in his late 50s, early 60s, but he looked a man of a lot older and like he enjoyed life, but he was quite a character.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm sorry that we didn't
hook
up sooner.
You've been great. Yeah. I'm just happy that I finally got to talk to you.
Yeah.